Ayrım 4.
Sayfa 27. Rhetoric itself he presents as a morally neutral technique which can be used for either right or wrong purposes. To blame a teacher of rhetoric for its misuse by his pupils would be as silly as to blame a teacher of boxing for the uses to which pupils may put their craft afterwards. The idea that techniques of persuasion are morally neutral is a recurrent one in human society, but in order to hold that such techniques are neutral, it is necessary also to hold that it is morally irrelevant whether a man comes to a given belief by reasoning or in some non-rational way. And in order to hold that this is morally irrelevant, one would have to hold also that a man's exercise of his rationality is irrelevant to his standing as a moral agent, irrelevant, that is, to deciding whether he is entitled to be called responsible and his actions voluntary. Thus, different elucidations of the concepts of responsibility and voluntary actions are presupposed by different moral attitudes to the standing of the techniques of persuasion. The philosophical task of elucidation cannot therefore be morally irrelevant, and one of the more obscurantist features of a sophist like Gorgias, and indeed of his later successors among the electioneering politicians of liberal democracy, the advertising executives, and other open and hidden persuaders, is the willingness to assume a whole philosophical psychology. It is this which leads Socrates to develop an argument to show that rhetoric is not a genuine art at all, but a mere spurious imitation of an art. By this time, Gorgias has been replaced in the argument by his pupil Polus. Polus reiterates that the moral point of the use of rhetoric is the acquisition of power. The successful orator can do whatever he wants. Socrates' retort to this is that a man may do whatever he thinks it good to do, and nonetheless not be doing what he desires. Here Socrates' point is that where a man does one thing for the sake of another, if he is intellectually mistaken as to the character of the connection between what he does and that for the sake of which he does it, he may in fact be defeating his own ends. The despot who inflicts injury and death upon others may be doing what appears to him to minister to his own good, but he is mistaken. For, says Socrates, it is worse for a man to inflict wrong than to suffer it. Paul's counterexample is the tyrant Archelaus of Macedon, who had acquired power by successive episodes of treachery and assassination. Everybody, says Polus, would like to be Archelaus if he could. Socrates' point is, however, that whatever that is what people wish or not is irrelevant. For if that is what they wish, it can only be because of a mistake on their part as to what is for their own good. He now proceeds to convict Polus of such a mistake, but he is able to do so only because of the state of the moral vocabulary which has already been described. Polus is not prepared to admit that it is worse, kakion, to inflict injury without due cause than to suffer it, but he is prepared to concede that it is more disgraceful, aistion. In order to understand this, we must recall the contrast between the pairs of adjectives, good, bad, agathos, kakos, and honorable, disgraceful, kalos, aistios. What is kalos is what is well thought of. To be the Athenian ideal of a gentleman, kalos, kagathos, one had both to be and to be thought good. The reference of kalos and aistios is to how a man appears. Polus is prepared to redefine agathos because the customary sense has become unclear, but because precisely of his commitment to winning popular favor, he is committed to popular estimations of reputation. He cannot commend his own valuations to his hearers unless at some point at least he appears to accept theirs. This is why Plato is able to observe later in the dialogue that the man who seeks to master the people by persuading them is forced in order to do this to accept their standards and so is mastered by them. Polus therefore accepts the view that it is more disgraceful to inflict injury undeservedly than it is to suffer it. But Socrates forces upon him the recognition that the predicates kalos and aistios are not criterionless. Socrates takes examples of these predicates applied elsewhere. Note that once again there's a translation difficulty. Kalos means both beautiful and honorable, aistios both ugly and disgraceful. Namely, to sounds and colors, to ways of life, and to sciences. From these examples, he draws the conclusion that we are entitled to call something kalos if it is useful or pleasant or both in the eyes of a disinterested spectator. Thus, if Polus agrees that to suffer injury undeservedly is more honorable, it must be because it is pleasanter and more beneficial. But for Polus, these define the content of what a man wants, so he can no longer consistently dissent from Socrates' view. A further very simple conceptual point is at issue here, which Plato does not bring out explicitly. Anyone who tries to explain good as meaning what X thinks to be good is involved in a vicious, because both vacuous and interminable, regress. For in order to understand this elucidation, we must already understand good in some other way. If not, we are involved in writing out our definition as what X thinks to be, what X thinks to be, what X thinks to, dot, dot, dot. Now to attempt to define moral terms by reference to how people in general define them presupposes, likewise, that if one is not to be involved in such a regress, one already grasps the moral concepts possessed by people in general, and it is this that traps Polus. His successor in the dialogue, Callicles, is not prepared to be trapped. He grasps that what betrayed both Polus and Gorgias was their insufficiently systematic redefinition of moral terms. For Callicles, the supreme good is power to satisfy all desires. Callicles' position is indeed a complex one. He is contemptuous of the life of theorizing and contemptuous, therefore, of Socrates. He is involved at once in two disagreements with Socrates. The first is over the concept of desire. Socrates argues that the man of boundless desires is like a leaky sieve, never filled, never satisfied. Therefore, to have great and violent desires is to make it certain that you will not get what you want. Unless our desires are delimited, they are not satisfiable. Callicles refuses to accept this. All that we need to do at this point is to underline the fact that the concepts of desire and of satisfaction present problems which Callicles' analysis passes by. Secondly, when Callicles at an earlier stage in the dialogue proclaimed the right of the strong man to rule, he clearly intended by this to glorify the despot. Socrates, however, points out that the populace are in an obvious sense stronger than the tyrant, and therefore, on Callicles' view, ought to rule. Callicles has therefore to redefine the concept of the stronger as meaning the more intelligent, and this at once raises for him the problem of what intelligence in a ruler consists in. Before Socrates can compare his answer on this point to that of Callicles, he clarifies certain key philosophical differences between them. The first of Socrates' points is that the pair of concepts, good, bad, differs from the concepts pleasure, pain, in that the former are contradictories, the latter not. If I assert that something is in some respect good, then it follows that I am committed to the view that the same thing is not bad in the same respect. But according to Socrates, if I assert that something is pleasant in some respect, it does not follow that it is not painful or unpleasant in the same respect. This unfortunate argument depends upon a thoroughly misleading example. If I am taking pleasure in eating because I am not yet satisfied, my discomfort at not yet being satisfied and my pleasure coexist. So I enjoy pleasure and pain simultaneously. But of course the pleasure is and derives from one thing, the pain is and derives from another. The opposite point that Socrates makes is that good and bad cannot be synonymous with pleasant and painful, for we use good and bad in evaluating pleasures and pains. Callicles thinks the good man to be intelligent and courageous. But a coward may feel more relief than a courageous man when danger is avoided, and so more pleasure. Callicles is therefore persuaded to concede a distinction between kinds of pleasure, and this is just what the Platonic Socrates needs. Socrates then develops his own positive view, and in so doing gains certain permanent ground in moral philosophy. Callicles' ideal is of a good which consists in the pursuit of one's desires without limit. Socrates had already suggested that limitless desire is unsatisfiable desire. Now he argues that the concept of good is necessarily bound up with the concept of observing a limit, and anything that is to count as a way of living will necessarily have some order or form by which we can distinguish it from other ways of living. So any good which we desire can only be specified by specifying the rules which would govern the behavior which would be or procure that particular good. Toward the close of the Gorgias, there are two other important moments. One is when Socrates attacks bitterly the line of Athenian statesmen from Miltiades to Pericles, whose expansionist policies taught the Athenians to have desires without teaching them the connection between the goods they might desire and the rule-governed order within which alone goods can be realized. The second is the discussion of the religious myth of judgment and punishment in the afterlife. With this myth, Plato symbolizes what is at stake in the choice between different fundamental moral attitudes. Both the political and the religious attitudes exemplified here are recurrent features of Plato's thought, which are treated very misleadingly if conceived of as external to his moral analysis. But in order to understand why this is so, we should have to examine the political and metaphysical background to the dialogues more fully, and before doing this, it is perhaps worth reiterating in summary form a number of conclusions toward which an inspection of the arguments in the Gorgias tends to push us. The first of these is that the advice, "Do whatever you want to," is necessarily useless except in a severely restricted context. When Socrates says that unquenchable desire is unsatisfiable desire, this is not just a matter of there being always something more that is desired. Rather, it is that a desire is only satisfiable if it is given a specified object. When we say to people, "Do whatever you want," this makes sense where there are a number of clearly defined alternatives, and we do not wish our preferences to weigh with the agent. But to say to the agent who asks the general moral questions, how shall I live, what shall I do, do whatever you want to, specifies no goal to be pursued. The problem is to know which ones to pursue, which to discourage, and so on. The correct retort to the injunction, gather ye rosebuds while ye may, is which rosebuds? It is a companion error to suppose in any case that my wants are given, fixed, and determinate, while my choices are free. My wants are not simply determinative of my choices. They are often enough the material on which choice has to be exercised. This is blurred by conceiving of moral concepts as part of the realm of convention, but of desires as part of nature. Socrates does not, of course, pursue any of these points, and he does not answer his own question any more than Gorgias answered it. What he does is to state one necessary condition for an answer to the question, what does a good consist in? The answer is that if anything is to be a good and a possible object of desire, it must be specifiable in terms of some set of rules which might govern behavior. The Calliclean injunction to break all rules, if you want to, that is, does not make sense. For a man whose behavior was not rule-governed in any way would have ceased to participate as an intelligible agent in human society. This is brought out not only by the content of the Gorgias, but also by its form. Even Callicles and Socrates share certain concepts, and the dialogue form brings out the way in which it is this sharing which enables Socrates to bring home to Callicles the internal incoherence of Callicles' view. This suggests that badness consists in a breach with a form of life in which certain goods can be attained, for to share concepts is always to share a form of life to some degree. And indeed Socrates affirms explicitly in the Gorgias that what the bad man lacks is an ability to koinonein, to share a common life. Koinonein. Thus, a necessary step forward in specifying what is good is to specify the kind of common life necessary for the good to be realized. This is the task of the Republic. Chapter 5. Plato, The Republic. The Republic opens with a request for a definition of dikaiune, and the first book clarifies the nature of this request. The definition of justice as telling the truth and paying one's debts is rejected, not only because it may sometimes be right to withhold the truth or not to return what one has borrowed, but because no list of types of action could supply what Plato is demanding. What he wants to know is what it is about an action or class of actions which leads us to call it just. He wants not a list of just actions, but a criterion for inclusion in or exclusion from such a list. Again, a definition of justice as doing good to one's friends and harm to one's enemies is rejected not just because of the argument that to harm someone would be to make him worse, that is, more unjust, with the consequence that the just man would be involved in making men less just, but because any definition of justice in terms of doing good and the like is bound to be unilluminating. When Thrasymachus comes upon the scene, he tells Socrates that Socrates is not to offer him a definition which tells him that justice is the same as what is obligatory, or useful, or advantageous, or profitable, or expedient. Socrates retorts that this is like asking what 12 is and refusing to accept any answer of the form that it is twice 6, or 3 times 4, or 6 times 2, or 4 times 3. But Socrates does accept the task of offering a quite different kind of elucidation. It would be a mistake to suppose that when Socrates does offer us a formula, namely that justice is that state of affairs in which everyone has regard to his own concerns, this is in itself the answer that was being sought. This formula is unintelligible apart from the rest of the Republic, and Thrasymachus is right to suppose that the search for expressions synonymous with dikaiune would not be to the point. For to be puzzled about a concept is not like being puzzled about the meaning of an expression in a foreign language. To offer a verbal equivalent to an expression about whose meaning we are conceptually puzzled will not help us, for if what we are offered is a genuinely synonymous expression, then all that puzzled us originally will puzzle us in the translation. To understand a concept, to grasp the meaning of an expression, is partially but crucially to grasp its functions, to understand what can and cannot be done with and through it. Moreover, we cannot decide what words are to mean or what role concepts are to play by fiat. We may on occasion wish to introduce a new concept and so legislate as to the meaning of a new expression, but what we can say in a given situation is limited by the common stock of concepts and the common grasp of their functions. No objection to the Republic is therefore more misconceived than that which would have been made by Humpty Dumpty: when I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. And which was in fact made by Professor Karl Popper when he wrote, "But was Plato perhaps right?" Footnote: Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There, Chapter 6. Does justice perhaps mean what he says? I do not intend to discuss such a question. I believe that nothing depends upon words and everything upon our practical demands or decisions. Footnote: The Open Society, Volume 1, Chapter 6, page 78. The point I have tried to make is that only those demands and decisions are open to us which there are concepts available to express, and that therefore the investigation of what concepts we either must or may use is crucial. Thrasymachus' own elucidation of the concept of justice is as follows. He does not believe that just means what is to the interest of the stronger, but he does believe that, as a matter of historical fact, rulers and ruling classes invented the concept and the standards of justice for their own purposes, and that it is in fact more profitable to do what is unjust rather than just. Socrates' initial probing of Thrasymachus' position is highly reminiscent of the Gorgias. He questions the concept of the stronger just as he did before, and he argues that the techne of ruling, on the analogy of the techne of medicine, must, if it is true art, be practiced for the benefit of those upon whom it is exercised. Medicine is for the benefit of patients, not for that of doctors, and so ruling must be for the benefit of the people, not of the rulers. But this thoroughly ineffectual analogy only belongs to the preliminary sparring. The position that Socrates had finally restated in the Gorgias is one which can be strikingly attacked from Thrasymachus' premises, and is so attacked by Socrates' own disciples, Glaucon and Adeimantus. But before Socrates completes the reiteration of his earlier attack on unlimited self-assertion, that restraint within the personality and between people is a condition of their well-being. He invokes the concept of arete and the notion that there is a specifically human virtue to exercise which will be to be in a state of well-being or happiness. Arete belongs now not to a man's specific social function, but to his function as a man. The connection between virtue and happiness is written into this concept in what initially must seem an arbitrary way. The rest of the argument of the Republic is an attempt to remove this arbitrariness. The revival of Thrasymachus' case by Glaucon Adeimantus runs as follows. Men in a state of nature are moved entirely by self-interest. The origin of laws lies in the moment when men discovered and agreed that clashes of self-interest were so damaging that it was more to their interest to forego doing injury to others than to continue in their natural way of life, so risking any injury that others might do to them. And ever since, men have obeyed the law only from fear of consequences. If men could avoid suffering the ill consequences of their actions, unlimited self-love would manifest itself openly instead of in law-abiding disguises. Suppose two men, one man now apparently just, the other unjust, were given a magic ring, such as Giges had to make himself invisible, so that both had complete liberty of action, then both would behave in the same way. They would, like Giges, who seduced his queen and murdered his king, pursue the path of complete self-aggrandizement. That is, everyone prefers injustice to justice, if he can be unjust successfully. This example depends on what fallacious portrait of the pre-social, natural man, which I have already criticized. For Plato's suggestion is that perhaps Giges, with his ring, is natural man. The superiority of the present case over that originally put into the mouth of Thrasymachus is that Plato now turns sharply toward the identification of self-interest as a trait in social and not merely in natural man. He makes Adeimantus stress that the conventionally virtuous and just citizen is on one side of Thrasymachus, not of Socrates. For the Greek equivalent of the bourgeois father teaches his children to pursue virtue and to flee vice precisely and only because virtue brings rewards and vice has unfortunate consequences both in this world and in the next. But if these are the only reasons for praising virtue, how can justice in itself and apart from any rewards be more profitable than injustice? Plato's answer is to try to show what justice is, first in the state and then in the soul. He outlines a state in which all basic needs are met. Three classes of citizens are required, artisans and laborers to produce the material needs of society, soldiers to defend the state, and rulers to organize its social life. The key transition here is from recognizing three functions which have to be discharged in social life to asserting that three distinct and separate classes of citizens are needed, one to discharge each function. Plato relies for this transition upon two beliefs, one not certainly true and one certainly false. The belief which is not certainly true is that one man is better to stick to one job, that this form of the division of labor is under all possible circumstances the best form, The belief, which is certainly false, is that men are by nature divided up into men best suited for each of these functions. Of this belief, it might just be noted that it is invoked most often by those who believe that people like themselves are well suited to rule, while others are not, and that it ignores the fact that most people have different capacities which do not exclude one another, let alone the fact that in existing societies most abilities of most people are unrealized. But Plato's beliefs on this point were powerfully reinforced by his doctrine of the tripartite soul. The arguments for the tripartite soul are independent of those for the tripartite state, but it is necessary for the doctrine of the tripartite state that at least something like the doctrine of the tripartite soul should be true. That the soul has parts is shown, according to Plato, by the fact that it has conflicts. If a given man desires to drink because he is thirsty, and does not desire to drink because he suspects the condition of the water, at one and the same time, then, since the same predicate cannot both hold and not hold of the same subject in the same respect at one and the same time, there must be at least two different subjects, of one of which we are predicating the desire to drink, and of the other of which we are predicating the desire not to drink. The assumption which underlies this argument is that a man cannot simultaneously desire to do something and desire not to do it, in the same sense in which a man cannot simultaneously move in a given direction and not move in that direction. But where desires are concerned, a man may desire some end envisaged under a particular description and not desire it under some other description. So a man may want to drink the water because he is thirsty, but want not to drink in case he risks an illness. It might perhaps seem that the short way to escape Plato's argument here is to say that the man just does not have incompatible desires. He desires to quench his thirst, and he desires not to be ill, and it is merely a contingent fact that this water would both quench his thirst and make him ill. But to this the rejoinder might be that his desires remain incompatible, for what the man desires is to drink this particular water, and what he fears is to drink this same water. Yet Plato is only right in a sense about these being incompatible desires, and that they are does not have any of the consequences which he supposes to follow. And this is because the incompatibility belongs to the possibility of satisfying both desires, not of having both desires. This is important because Plato uses his bad argument to expound a distinction between that part of the soul which is the appetites and that part which is the reason, a distinction which exerts enormous pressure upon some subsequent moral philosophy. Plato's picture of the parts of the soul is not in fact coherent. Sometimes he speaks as though the rational part of the soul had one set of desires and the appetitive part another. At other times, as if the appetites were the desires and reason essentially a check and restraint upon them. He speaks as though the desire to drink was an unrational craving, the apprehension of danger from drinking an insight of reason. But in fact, we do not first have desires and then afterwards reason about them. We learn, and we use our reason in learning, to desire certain things, Plato does not distinguish the biologically determined appetite from the conscious human desire, and the desire to quench one's thirst is as rational as the desire not to be injured by poison in the water. It is just not true that only our restraint upon ourselves derives from reflection. It is often upon reflection that we decide that we need to drink. An irrational fear of being poisoned might be checked by a reasonable desire to quench one's thirst, just as much as vice versa. An irrational desire to quench one's thirst might be inhibited by a rational fear of poison. What makes a desire reasonable or unreasonable is its relation to our other purposes and choices, possible as well as actual. A man may behave unreasonably by not allowing his desires play, and desire may on occasion correct an agent's would-be rational assessments. But these facts Plato and a long tradition which is to follow him rule out of court in order to maintain that rigid division between reason and the appetites in which reason is always to be in the right. The original source of this distinction is of course not in Plato's own arguments from the alleged facts of conflict, but in his inherited Pythagorean and Orphic beliefs in the separation of an immortal soul from a body that is a prison and a tomb. But later writers who might have been unimpressed by the religious doctrine have still been content with the philosophical distinction. Plato himself gives a far more interesting and positive account of desire in the Symposium, but even here desire leads us away from this world in the end. Plato's doctrinal allegiances lead him in the Republic not merely to draw false conclusions from the facts of conflict, but also, as I have just suggested, to misdescribe them. The essence of conflict of desire is that it provides an occasion for choice on my part between my desires, even if I do not choose. But Plato's division of the soul into parts makes conflict a tug of war, which could not be an occasion for choice. I am not confronted with my desires. I am split between two autonomous parties, reason and appetite, or else I am reason struggling against appetite. Nor is Plato consistent here with his other writings. The Greek word for soul, psohe, means originally simply that which makes the difference between life and death, between a man and a corpse. Some early Greek thinkers identified the soul with a material substance, the Pythagoreans with a harmony between the elements of the body, a balance. Plato argues against both in the Phaedo that the soul is an immaterial simple substance, that to be destroyed is to be divided up into parts, and that since the soul has no parts, it must be immortal. Appetite in the Phaedo belongs to the body, so that the distinction between reason and appetite remains a constant element, pointing to the continuity of the religious background. But the Phaedo offers us no grounds for believing in the division into parts of the soul. The division of the soul in the Republic is not just between reason and appetite. There is also the spirited part, which is concerned neither with rational standards of behavior nor with bodily desires, but with standards of honorable behavior and with anger and indignation. Plato tells the story of Leontius, who, overcome with desire, stares at the corpses of executed criminals, cursing himself as he does so. The Platonic moral is that anger and appetite can conflict. The spirited part of the soul acts when it is not corrupted by a bad upbringing, as an agent of reason, being indignant when reason is overborne. So a man who has been wronged feels indignant, but a man who feels that he is in the wrong cannot find it in his nature to be indignant if he is made to suffer in turn. So Plato says. Men therefore fall into three classes depending upon which part of the soul is dominant. This division is that required by the tripartite state. Into which class a man falls may in part be a matter of his early training, but cannot fundamentally be so determined. Plato believes that there are born shoemakers and born rulers. Justice in the state is a matter of everyone knowing his place. Of the four traditional virtues, courage belongs to the class of auxiliary guardians, whose function is defense, and wisdom to the ruling guardians. Temperance is a virtue not of a class, but of the society as a whole, because the desires of the inferior multitude will be controlled by the desires and wisdom of the superior few. Justice belongs not to this nor to that class, nor to particular relationships between classes, but to the society's functioning as a whole. Justice in the soul is likewise a matter of each part of the soul performing its proper and allotted function. An individual is wise in virtue of reason ruling in him, and brave in virtue of the spirited part playing its role. An individual is temperate if his inferior bodily appetites are ruled by his reason. But justice belongs not to this or that part or relationship of the soul, but to its total ordering. The two questions then arise: what sort of man will be just, and how could the just state come about? These questions are asked and answered together, and this is no accident. When later on Plato comes to discuss the corruption of state and soul, he treats them as belonging together. Moreover, the just man will rarely exist except in the just state, where at least some men, the future rulers, are systematically educated in justice. But the just state cannot possibly exist except where there are just men. So the questions of how the state can come to be and of how the just man is to be educated have to be posed together. And so we reach the point where Plato brings on stage the ideal of the philosopher king. Plato defines a philosopher by setting out an account of knowledge and belief, and then contrasting the philosopher who knows with the non-philosophical man who at best has only true belief or opinion. The argument begins from considering the meaning of pairs and predicates, and the examples used are beautiful and ugly, just and unjust, and good and bad. Plato says that, since beautiful and ugly are opposite, they are two, and so each of them is one. Footnote: Republic, Book 5, 475e, 476a. But many things exhibit beauty and many things are ugly. So that there's a difference between those who are aware of this or that object as beautiful and those who grasp what beautiful itself is. I use this expression, beautiful itself, autotokalon, to translate Plato's innovating use of itself to convert an adjective into an expression that names what the adjective is supposed to mean or stand for.